Before we start the show, just a reminder to share, like, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening to it. And please, give us a 5-star rating. It helps us beat the big tech algorithm. Also, if you love Red Pilled America, please consider supporting the show. You can buy one of our 100% Made in America products. We have hats, candles, a book. That's right, we wrote a book. Or you can become a Backstage subscriber. Well, you'll have access to our entire archive, and you can hear the behind the scenes of each episode, along with Patrick and I arguing over who's a better storyteller. Or you can just make a donation. To support the show, please visit redpilledamerica.com and click support or shop in the top menu. That's redpilledamerica.com and click support or shop in the top menu. Support what you love or it goes away. Thanks, everyone.
Most conservatives see public broadcasting as a left-wing operation. Public broadcasting is required to have political balance on controversial issues. But the political bias of NPR and PBS seemed to find its way into their shows. Perhaps one C-SPAN caller put it best in 2014 when chastising a head executive of the public broadcasting industry.
The non-political shows are great. All the political shows you have, though, are far left-wing. Almost every one covers three subjects: global warming, racism, and homosexuality stuff.
Given its obvious left-wing bias, what can conservatives do to fix public broadcasting? I'm Patrick Carelci.
And I'm Adriana Cortez.
And this is Red Pilled America, a storytelling show.
This is not another talk show covering the day's news. We are all about telling stories.
Stories Hollywood doesn't want you to hear.
Stories the media mocks. Stories about everyday Americans that the globalists ignore.
You could think of Red Pilled America as audio documentaries, and we promise only one thing: the truth.
Welcome to Red Pilled America.
No one can deny that public broadcasting puts out some high-quality content. From NPR shows like This American Life to PBS's series Frontline, some of the country's best-produced documentaries come from the public broadcasting networks. But to many on the right, it goes without saying that the entire ecosystem has a left-wing slant. Can anything be done to fix this problem? To find the answer, we tell the story of one of NPR's biggest controversies and take a journey to the origin of public broadcasting. We also speak to Mike Gonzalez, a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation and an expert on public broadcasting. NPR and PBS have long been the bane of conservatives, and maybe the movement needs to think out of the box on how to fix the problem.
It was the summer of 2010 when a debate began to rage in Lower Manhattan.
I'm not racist, thank you. No, I'm not. You're saying that so that it makes it sound like I'm racist.
A New York City developer was approved to build an Islamic mosque just two blocks from Ground Zero. The developer called it the Cordoba House, and when news of the project spread throughout the area, a town hall meeting was organized to address the community's concerns. Supporters and opponents of the development predictably clashed over the project.
And I could not be more further from the truth of racism.
Let her continue.
And I apologize.
It's okay.
I apologize to Dave's up there.
We need to get the police to quiet this person.
National Public Radio, or NPR, covered the building controversy in the way they often do, feigning an unbiased perspective on the hot-button topic.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Today we want to talk about a building, the proposed Islamic Center, a couple of blocks from Ground Zero. So just to make it clear, the center in New York has already been approved, and the issue now is whether or not the building should receive special landmark preservation status, which would mean that the 13-story building couldn't be torn down. But the center is likely to move forward regardless.
Michelle Martin, a longtime journalist for National Public Radio, was executing NPR's patented approach to covering the news. That is, she played the role of the neutral host, while her equally impartial liberal-leaning guest delivered an opinion on the matter.
The fact is, there are a lot of people who are still very angry about it. Maybe they just found out about it. What steps would you take to address these feelings?
we have to get to a larger conversation about people's aspirations for their communities, not their fears and preconceived notions and maybe their prejudices.
Sarah Palin, the former vice presidential candidate, sent a series of Twitter posts on Sunday asking the Muslim community to move away from the site in the interest of healing. I mean, she's suggesting that people may have a right to build a site there, but they should make the gesture to the larger community, as she put it, in the interest of healing. What do you make of that argument?
Well, you know, this is your segment on faith, right? And forgiveness actually often begins with those who have been perceived to be wronged in something, not those who have necessarily perpetrated it.
In other words, it was the responsibility of Americans like Sarah Palin to roll over on the issue of a mosque at Ground Zero. Over the decades, NPR has developed a masterful way of camouflaging their bias, a technique that most honest right-leaning listeners can identify. Namely, the public radio network cherry-picks facts to lead the audience towards the worldview of NPR's liberal staff.
One thing I think has been lost in all this is that there are many Muslims who lost their lives on 9/11, both 10%. at the World Trade Center, both and at the Pentagon, that there are people of the Muslim faith who lost their lives.
As the summer of 2010 progressed, the Ground Zero mosque debate just wouldn't go away, and it was to be expected. The country was in the midst of a midterm election cycle, and the issue created a clear contrast for voters, a contrast that became even more stark when then-President Obama entered the fray.
I understand the emotions that this issue engenders, and Ground Zero is indeed hallowed ground. But let me be clear. As a citizen and as president, I believe that Muslims have the right to practice their religion as everyone else in this country. And that includes the right to build a place of worship and a community center on private property in Lower Manhattan in accordance with local laws and ordinances. This is America, and our commitment to religious freedom must be unshakable. The principle that people of all faiths are welcome in this country and that they will not be treated differently by their government is essential to who we are. The writ of the founders must endure.
That's when the issue went nuclear. Republican politicians and pundits stepped up the rhetoric on the national debate.
Nazis don't have the right to put up a sign next to the Holocaust Museum in Washington. We would never accept the Japanese putting up a site next to Pearl Harbor. Right. There's no reason for us to accept a mosque next to the World Trade Center.
I'm a reasonable human being. I have no problem with a mosque. You want to build a church, a mosque, a synagogue, any place, that's fine. You want to build it and you want to open it on September 11th? You're a fool.
It was a debate that the right appeared to be winning, and that seemed to bother the staff at NPR. You see, prior to Obama's comments, National Public Radio had a nuanced approach to covering the controversy. But now that the scale of public opinion was leaning to the right, journalists at NPR took a noticeably more aggressive approach.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. There was a time after the 9/11 attacks when American officials struggled to make a crucial point. From President Bush on down, they said Osama bin Laden did not represent all Muslims.
They said it would be a victory for al-Qaeda if Americans turned against the entire Muslim world. 9 years after 9/11, American politicians are doing what they were warned against.
A plan for an Islamic center 2 blocks away from the World Trade Center site has created a political opportunity, and many candidates are seizing that opportunity.
To be clear, Republicans are not the only opponents of the Islamic Center. Republicans are the ones who appear to be eager to use the issue to put Democrats on the defensive in this fall's elections.
Even NPR's Michelle Martin began to express her feelings on the matter. During an appearance on CNN, a guest panelist suggested the Cordoba House developers move the mosque away from Ground Zero. Michelle Martin countered the idea.
And wouldn't it be a great thing if they moved it a few blocks and Muslims and Americans who still worry would be talking to each other?
Why should
Let's compromise.
It?
Well, why don't we compromise?
Did anybody move a Christian church after Timothy McVeigh, who adhered to a cultic, white supremacist, cultic version of Christianity?
You know, even now, if somebody tried to build a...
Michelle Martin was mistaken. Domestic terrorist Timothy McVeigh was not a Christian. The day before his execution, he identified himself as agnostic. But the NPR journalist skipped over that fact to argue in support of the Ground Zero Mosque. As Election Day 2010 approached, the issue was still raging as Bill O'Reilly swaggered onto the set of The View.
Please welcome Bill O'Reilly.
The producers must have been hoping for fireworks because it was obvious that The View co-hosts, Joy Behar and Whoopi Goldberg, were not big fans of the then Fox News nighttime host, a fact Bill O'Reilly addressed immediately.
Look at you. Every time I come on here, she's, how did this happen?
Bill, I have a case of gas. That's all that's...
As the discussion progressed, O'Reilly inevitably brought up the hot topic.
And let me break this to you. 70% of Americans don't want that moss down there.
Where's
so don't give me the wee bit.
I want to see that.
You want to bet on that? You want to bet? I'll show you that poll in a minute.
All I'm saying is that Americans
don't want it. 70%
don't want it.
But why is that? But why aren't we saying...
Because it's inappropriate.
Why is it inappropriate?
Well, 70 families died.
What are you talking about?
On 9/11.
No! Oh, my God!
All hell broke loose.
Muslims didn't kill us on 9/11? Is that what you're saying?
Excuse me, extremists.
What religion were they in?
What religion was Mr. McVeigh? Mr. McVeigh was an extremist as well, and he killed people.
70% of the country.
I don't want to sit here.
In protest, Whoopi Goldberg and Joy Behar walked off the set. It looked like this would be the peak of the Ground Zero mosque debate. But things were just about to get interesting. Netflix, Hulu, HBO Max, Disney Plus, Apple TV, Amazon Prime, Showtime, Paramount, Paramount Plus, and on and on. What do these streaming services have in common? They are all storytelling platforms. Which of these platforms are you supporting with your hard-earned money? Now ask yourself if the stories being told on those platforms truly align with your worldview. And if they don't, ask yourself where you go to get entertainment in the form of storytelling that does align with your worldview. Red Pilled America is that show. We are not another talk show covering today's news. We are all about telling stories. 3 years later, we remain the only show of our kind. And why aren't there more shows like ours? Because it's expensive to create this kind of content. That's why we need your support. Without your support, this show doesn't survive. And more importantly, there'll be zero change to the monopolistic environment of storytelling. Please visit redpilledamerica.com and click support in the top menu. Support what you love or it goes away. The choice is yours. Welcome back to Red Pilled America.
Today on The View, Rochelle, HLN host Joy Behar and Fox News host Bill O'Reilly were discussing a proposed mosque near Ground Zero. Well, they had a difference of opinion, to put it mildly.
On his next show, Bill O'Reilly brought up his feud on The View with Fox News commentator Juan Williams.
So where am I going wrong there, Juan?
Well, actually, I hate to say this to you because I don't want to get your ego going, but I think you're right. I think, look, political correctness can lead to some kind of paralysis where you don't address reality. I mean, look, Bill, I'm not a bigot, you know, the kind of books I've written about the civil rights movement in this country. But when I get on a plane, I got to tell you, if I see people who are in Muslim garb, and I think, you know, they're identifying themselves first and foremost as Muslims, I get worried. I get nervous.
The comment seemed pretty tame. But at the time, Juan Williams wasn't just a Fox News commentator. He was also a news analyst for National Public Radio. And his candid statement was at complete odds with NPR's sanctioned narrative. It wasn't long before NPR CEO Vivian Schiller gave Juan Williams the boot.
An analyst with National Public Radio has been fired.
Juan Williams fired by NPR.
NPR's chief executive Vivian Schiller issued a written statement saying in part, Williams' remarks on the O'Reilly factor this past Monday were inconsistent with our editorial standards and practices and undermined his credibility as a news analyst with NPR.
NPR CEO held a press conference to address her decision.
He has been a frequent contributor to Fox News. That's fine. We don't necessarily have an issue with that. However, we expect anybody that appears on our air, either as a journalist or a news analyst, to conduct themselves according to our journalistic rules of ethics, wherever they might be in any forum and in any venue. There have been several incidences over the years where Juan has strayed from that line. in this case, we decided that his integrity as a news analyst has been undermined by the fact that he has expressed these very divisive views, and those two things are not compatible. His feelings that he expressed on Fox News are really between him and his, you know, psychiatrist or his publicist or take your pick, but it is not compatible with the role of a news analyst on NPR's air.
The firing reeked of political bias. Just a few months earlier, NPR journalist Michelle Martin falsely aligned Christians with domestic terrorist Timothy McVeigh. Yet, she still had a job. And days earlier, another NPR journalist had labeled Tea Party Republicans as extremist.
Can you think of another time in American history when there have been as many people running for Congress who seem to be on the extreme?
Critics of the firing noted other times NPR journalists made controversial comments but weren't fired, including when Nina Totenberg suggested that God might give the AIDS virus to the grandchildren of a Republican senator for his policy positions.
I don't think I have any Jesse Helms defenders here, Nina.
Not me. I think he ought to be worried about the about what's going on in the good Lord's mind, because if there's retributive justice, he'll get AIDS from a transfusion, or one of his grandchildren will get it.
People were outraged by NPR's firing of Juan Williams. In the immediate aftermath, Juan was asked why he thought NPR fired him.
So what do you think the issue is here? Do you think it's just that the fact that you were working for Fox became too much trouble for NPR?
I think, you know what, this is one of the things in my life that's just such a shock to me, because I grew up basically on the left. I grew up here in New York City, and I've always thought the right wing was the ones who were inflexible and intolerant, and now I'm coming to realize that the orthodoxy at NPR, if it's representing the left, is just unbelievable.
Conservatives had long considered public broadcasting as left-wing. So the entire affair was perfectly positioned for them to mount an attack on NPR specifically and public broadcasting more broadly.
Conservatives and some liberals are lashing out at National Public Radio for firing one of its best-known voices, Juan Williams.
Mike Huckabee says he won't do any interviews on NPR.
Newt Gingrich accused NPR of censorship.
I think that the U.S. Congress should investigate NPR and consider cutting off their money.
Sarah Palin tweeted, "Lights shine on left's lamestream media lies and hypocrisy."
He explained his feelings, and the guy gets fired because it doesn't fit the left-wing dogma that you have to follow. And we put taxpayer money into that censorship program.
People listen to NPR and they walk away saying, God, it's just absolutely liberal in its orientation and its outlook and its reporting.
I'm a fan of NPR. I listen to it. My family's contributed to it. But why do they get federal money? Why should tax dollars go to a media outlet that is clearly a left of center?
It's a really bad strategic move for NPR. You know, this is a media entity that for years has been dogged by allegations of being too liberal.
NPR has a show called All Things Considered, and it turns out there aren't all things considered. There's a few viewpoints that are considered and considered worthy of airing.
NPR denies that their broadcasts have a liberal agenda, and they say very little of their money comes from the government anyway.
But now Republicans in Congress are trying to cut funding not only to NPR, but to all public broadcasting.
Senator Jim DeMint says he'll introduce a bill to end taxpayer subsidies. He says the firing of Williams just shows NPR promotes a one-sided liberal agenda.
I think we have a national momentum to defund NPR, and that's what should happen.
I do believe that will happen.
Juan Williams would quickly land on his feet. After his firing, he reportedly signed a multi-year deal with Fox News worth $2 million. But the turn of events put taxpayer funding for public broadcasting in the crosshairs of conservative Americans. At the time, public broadcasting was receiving $420 million annually. Calls to defund the entire operation grew to a fever pitch. While still in the eye of the tornado, NPR's ombudsman said the reaction to the firing had, quote, unleashed an unprecedented firestorm of criticism directed not at Williams, but at NPR, end quote. Within the first 24 hours of the controversy, NPR reportedly received more than 8,000 emails, which the ombudsman said was, quote, a record with nothing a close second, end quote. Conservative anger towards public broadcasting had been building up for decades, dating back to its launch. From day one, right-leaning America saw liberal bias throughout the newly formed ecosystem, which may lead one to wonder, how did this government-funded system even come into existence? To understand that, we need to go back to the 1950s, where public broadcasting finds its roots.
By the early 1950s, broadcasting was in its infancy. There was no cable TV, no internet, no podcasts, no streaming services. There were just three national networks, CBS, NBC, and ABC. All three were in both radio and television broadcasting. No other major national players were in the game. But there was an organization that was looking to throw its hat in the ring. Enter the Ford Foundation, a tax-exempt philanthropic outfit founded by automotive pioneer Henry Ford and his son Edsel. The Ford Foundation was formed in 1936, and when Henry Ford died in 1947, the foundation received the financial windfall of 90% of the non-voting shares of the Ford Motor Company. Shortly after his grandfather's death, the Ford Foundation's chairman, Henry Ford II, identified education as one of its primary areas of action. In 1952, the foundation made a move into the arena by funding the Educational Television and Radio Center in Ann Arbor, Michigan. The center was to distribute educational programming to both radio and television. Now, this was a touchy time for tax-exempt entities like the Ford Foundation. Members of Congress viewed many of them with a skeptical eye. They were concerned that the trustees heading the big ones like the Carnegie, Rockefeller, and Ford Foundations were adopting a subversive approach to their grant-making activities. And it wasn't some harebrained conspiracy theory. The Rockefeller Foundation funded Alfred Kinsey's controversial human sexual behavior studies, a line of research that would eventually lead to the transgender and broader LGBTQ movement. One U.S. congressman, Tennessee Congressman Brazilla Carol Reese, openly wondered, quote, "To what extent, if any, are the funds of the large foundations aiding and abetting Marxist tendencies and weakening the love which every American should have for his way of life?" So Congressman Reese set out to find the answer. He put together what would come to be known as the Reese Committee to investigate not the stated missions of the foundation, but instead their actions. He added an economist to the committee by the name of Norman Dodd. Dodd would become the director of research of the committee. Shortly before his passing in 1987, Dodd was asked in a series of interviews what his investigations found out about the tax-exempt foundations.
"We found out, Doctor, that these foundations had as their objective the orientation of the people of this country to the idea of collectivism, and thereby nullifying for good and all of the commitment of the country to individualism, which was the feature of the country at the beginning."
To do this, the large tax-exempt foundations honed in on education, and according to Norman Dodd, they used their vast resources to influence the entire United States educational system. It was their attempt to chip away at the fabric of American society. What the Reese Committee claimed to have found was that the trustees of these tax-exempt foundations were dramatically shifting away from the beliefs of the industrialists that created the foundation's wealth. They instead adopted an un-American Marxist ideology. When asked why they wanted to move the country towards Marxism, Norman Dodd had an answer.
"Well, because to them, what communism represents a means of developing what we call a monopoly. They will be the beneficiaries of it, yes."
Norman Dodd highlighted one off-the-record conversation he had with the president of the Ford Foundation, Horace Gaither, during his investigation. Mr. Gaither summoned Norman Dodd to his office in New York.
"And on arrival, after amenities, Mr. Gaither, who was the then president, said, 'Mr. Dodd, we invited you to come and see us this morning, hoping that you would, off the record, tell us why the Congress was interested in operations of foundations such as ours.' And before I could think of how I would reply to him, he volunteered the following. He said, 'Mr. Dodd, those of us here at the policy-making level have all had experience, either with the OSS or the European Economic Administration, in operating under directives, the origin of which was the White House. We today operate under just such directives. Would you like to know what the substance of these directives is? And I said, yes, Mr. Gaither, I'd like very much to know. Whereupon he said to me, the substance of the directives under which we operate is that we shall use our grant-making power so to alter life in the United States that we can be comfortably merged with the Soviet Union. Well, figuratively, I nearly fell off the chair.
The power of the Carnegie, Rockefeller, and Ford foundations proved to be too much for the Reese Committee. The tax-exempt organizations successfully marginalized the committee's findings. By 1954, the Ford Foundation continued their venture into so-called educational television by funding the National Educational Television Network, and the organization began distributing content.
This is National Educational Television, a program distributed by the Educational Television and Radio Center.
Now, the Ford Foundation had made such a dramatic shift towards radical causes that Henry Ford's grandson, Henry Ford II, resigned as chairman of the foundation in 1956. On his way out, he admonished the trustees, stating in his resignation letter that the foundation was, quote, a creation of capitalism. I'm just suggesting to the trustees and the staff that the system that makes the foundation possible very probably is worth preserving, end quote. A few years later, on April 3, 1961, the National Educational Radio Network used funding by the Ford Foundation to begin broadcasting on 6 radio stations. The seeds of public television and public radio were beginning to take root, but the cost of these endeavors were mounting, and the Ford Foundation began looking for ways to reduce their financial commitment, and their timing was impeccable.
Like everybody, I wear more than one hat. I am the chairman of the FCC, but I am also a television viewer and the husband and father of other television viewers.
On May 9, 1961, newly appointed FCC chairman Newton Minow gave a speech to the National Association of Broadcasters in Washington, D.C. Historians mark this as a turning point for public broadcasting. His speech, in effect, provided the rationale for the government to fund a new broadcasting network. The speech came to be known as the Vast Wasteland Speech, and in it, Newton Minow criticized the content of the entire broadcasting industry.
I have seen a great many programs that seem to me eminently worthwhile. When television is good, nothing, not the theater, not the magazines or newspapers, nothing is better. But when television is bad, nothing is worse. I invite each of you to sit down in front of your own television set when your station goes on the air. And stay there for a day. Keep your eyes glued to that set until the station signs off. I can assure you that what you will observe is a vast wasteland. You will see a procession of game shows, formula comedies about totally unbelievable families, blood and thunder, mayhem, violence, sadism, murder, Western bad men, Western good men, private eyes, gangsters, more violence and cartoons, and endlessly commercials, many screaming, cajoling, and offending. And most of all, boredom. True, you'll see a few things you will enjoy, but they will be very, very few. And if you think I exaggerate, I only ask you to try it. And most young children today, believe it or not, spend as much time watching television as they do in the schoolroom. Is there no room on television to teach, to inform, to uplift, to stretch, to enlarge the capacities of our children? Is there no room for a children's news show explaining something to them about the world at their level of understanding? Is there no room for reading the great literature of the past, for teaching them the great traditions of freedom? There are some fine children's shows, but they are drowned out in the massive doses of cartoons, violence, and more violence. Must these be your trademarks? Search your consciences and see if you cannot offer more to your young beneficiaries, whose future you guide so many hours each and every day.
It was effective rhetoric, and Newton Minow would go on to be considered one of the godfathers of public radio. He'd later head the Carnegie Foundation and played a part in Barack Obama's life. In the late 1980s, he recruited Obama to his law firm, where Barack met his future wife, Michelle. President Obama would return the favor by giving Newton Minow the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2016. A year after Newton Minow's 1961 speech, President Kennedy signed the Educational Television Facilities Act, which brought the first major federal funding to public broadcasting, authorizing roughly $25 million to create technical facilities for educational TV. The public broadcasting movement was gaining steam, so much so that a pioneer in radio and television news broadcasting got in on the action.
Good evening. I'm Ed Murrow, and this is Channel 13, WNDT, something rather different. This is educational television. It is 9 years old, quite young in the annals of education. But then television itself is but new come to being. This afternoon, there were 67 stations in the country. Tonight, this becomes the 68th. In time, there will be over 200 such stations. It will, in short, be the development of a new fourth television network, serving all the peoples of the 50 states that are this land. Educational television is non-profit. Upon these airwaves, you will see no commercials. The only thing this channel will sell is the lure of learning. The only product they will push is the node of knowledge. Tonight, you join me in being present at the birth of a great adventure.
Edward R. Murrow was a journalistic icon, but he was also an undercover radical. He sponsored a communist school in Moscow and played a hand in bringing Marxist professors from the German Frankfurt School to the United States, the same professors that would develop the woke ideology saturating universities, media, and all of modern American culture. To anyone that was paying attention, something fishy was developing in public broadcasting. The entire ecosystem was made up of leftists friendly to the socialist cause, and they were about to get a big boost.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Upon the death of JFK Jr., Lyndon B. Johnson became President of the United States. And it was just a few years earlier, when he was the senator from Texas, that the pioneers of public broadcasting sold him on the idea of a government-funded broadcasting network.
They really sold it, at least. They didn't mean it. At least they sold it as education television.
That's Mike Gonzalez, a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. In his well-researched 2017 article for the Knight Foundation, he argued for an end to taxpayer-funded public broadcasting. Mike Gonzalez notes that the pioneers of public broadcasting sold it as a government-funded educational network. Besides once being a teacher, Lyndon B. Johnson and his wife, Lady Bird, made their fortune in radio and TV. In the early 1950s, they owned the sole license for a commercial TV station in Austin, Texas. So Johnson understood the power of radio and TV.
When they met with Senator Johnson before he became vice president and then president, when he was a powerful senator from Texas, and he had been a principal in Cotulla, Texas, and that experience marked Johnson a great deal, at least he said it did. And they said, look, you can multiply. You have a teacher teaching thousands of kids rather than just 28 kids. And they sold it as education television.
The pioneers of public broadcasting argued that they'd air the local symphony orchestras and be the classroom in the TV. But by the 1960s, they were already drifting from that promise. The Ford Foundation, who'd been a primary funder of public broadcasting, had started experimenting with financing documentaries and public affairs programming that it distributed through its National Educational Television Network. Their content was saturated with the radical counterculture ideas of the 1960s, which Mike Gonzalez branded as, quote, an all-out assault on America's institutions, end quote. When the National Educational Television Network was rebranded as NET, those who were carefully watching could see that public broadcasting was evolving from an educational network to a news outfit. When Lyndon B. Johnson became president, even with this transformation underway, he sold the creation of public broadcasting to the American public as a much-needed educational service.
We should develop educational television into a vital public resource to enrich our homes, educate our families, and to provide assistance in our classrooms. And I will propose these measures to the 90th Congress.
Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967, and by doing so, he established the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or the CPB, the entity that distributes funds to public broadcasting networks and content creators.
Nationwide distribution of the preceding program is a service of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
The Public Broadcasting Act also transformed the National Educational Radio Network into National Public Radio, or NPR.
Thousands of young people came to Washington willing to risk being arrested in order to end the war. They went into the streets this morning to stop the government from functioning by clogging many Washington roads during this morning's rush hour.
In addition, it turned the National Educational Television Network into the Public Broadcasting System, better known as PBS. The cost of the far-left Ford Foundation's creations were now being subsidized by taxpayers. NPR and PBS officially began airing during the Nixon administration, and Nixon hated the networks. He tried to defund them. When he did, the young enterprise looked like it was on the ropes. But when the Watergate hearings commenced, PBS decided to cover the entire affair from start to finish. A public broadcasting executive at the time said, quote, "Nixon vetoed the funding bill, cut our funding, and now he's giving us our best programming," end quote. Again, Mike Gonzalez.
Every Republican president since Nixon has tried to defund the CPB, including also not a president, but Newt Gingrich when he was Speaker of the House. No Democrat president or speaker has ever tried to do that because they're very happy with the results.
And into the modern day, the large tax-exempt foundations still have a hand in funding public broadcasting.
Welcome back to Red Pilled America. In the wake of the Juan Williams firing, National Public Radio claimed that it was not biased, and it almost got away with that claim. But then in early 2011, a young journalist pulled the curtain back on NPR.
An NPR executive was caught on tape in a conservative sting.
Investigative journalist James O'Keefe had a team go undercover to investigate the public broadcasting network.
You're looking at a sting operation, a setup by people who know how to do it. NPR Foundation executive Ron Schiller thinks he's meeting with a potential donor, but he's actually being punked.
Last month, Schiller went to the posh Georgetown eatery Cafe Milano, where he thought he was meeting potential donors affiliated with the fundamentalist Muslim Brotherhood, who were offering a $5 million donation. He was caught on tape trying to ingratiate himself to the donors by disparaging Jews, the Tea Party, and Republicans.
The current Republican Party, but particularly the Tea Party, is fanatically involved in people's personal lives and very fundamental Christian, and I wouldn't even call it Christian. It's this weird evangelical move.
He also said the network would be better off without federal funding.
This, to me, is finally a window into how they really think. It's like you were tuning your radio, and just by accident, you got the right wavelength, and now you're hearing the truth.
Schiller was living down to the conservative stereotype of an NPR executive. Sneering, arrogant, utterly dismissive of views not his own. I mean, if you were to cast a character in the right-wing fever dream of NPR executive, it would be this guy.
Today, in response to that news, Schiller was placed on administrative leave. Remarks were captured as part of a video sting by conservative activist James O'Keefe at a time when public broadcasting is under assault.
O'Keefe pulled off what he called a long con, where his operatives set up an elaborate ruse to expose the left-wing bias of NPR.
O'Keefe and his operatives went to great lengths for this sting, even setting up a fake website for the Muslim Education Action Center. Then the operatives, posing as wealthy Muslim donors, set up a meeting at this D.C. restaurant and set up a hidden camera inside. I spoke with NPR president and CEO Vivian Schiller, who's not related to Ron Schiller, over the phone.
The comments made by Ron Schiller are an affront to this organization and are contrary to everything we stand for as a news organization.
Her response didn't save her job. The NPR CEO was eventually forced out, along with the executive caught in the sting.
The CEO of NPR submitted her resignation today. Their chief fundraiser was also shown the door. They're casualties in a war over culture and spending cuts that threatens the very existence of public broadcasting, including Big Bird and Elmo.
The House Rules Committee called an emergency meeting this afternoon to consider a bill that would cut government funding for NPR.
I think that the image that we have seen on the videos tells us something about the internal culture of NPR.
Listen to the executives at NPR that says that they don't need taxpayer funding. We ought to take that advice for what it is. Why should we allow taxpayer dollars to be used to advocate one ideology? Why should we? We shouldn't.
Schiller's remarks and their public disclosure could hardly come at a worse time for public broadcasting. House Republicans have voted to strip away all funding for public media starting in 2013, citing budget constraints and what they say is NPR's liberal bias.
But in the end, it was all talk. In 2013, public broadcasting received over $420 million from Washington, D.C., and those funds have been slowly increasing ever since. In 2024, public broadcasting is set to receive a whopping $525 million in taxpayer dollars.
Which leads us back to the question, what can conservatives do to fix public broadcasting? Well, the right can try to defund public broadcasting, but it's been failing at that for half a century. I mean, the GOP was unable to defund Planned Parenthood even after the country learned they sold the fetal tissue of aborted babies. Maybe the right should attempt something new. Perhaps it should try to infiltrate public broadcasting by creating its own organizations that can tap these massive funds. Think about it. The left also played the long con by transforming an educational network into a news organization. Now it has an annual slush fund of roughly $500 million to produce news and documentaries that help keep the Democrats in power. NPR and PBS have led the way in defining the narrative of almost every hot-button issue in America. From its beginning, it helped turn the public against Richard Nixon to modern times, where it's received a prestigious Peabody Award for its coverage on the so-called insurrection of January 6th, but was absent in characterizing the George Floyd riots as the insurrection it was. Maybe the way to fix public broadcasting is for the right to infiltrate the industry, to become conservative public broadcasters, because even NPR admits that their entire organization is staffed almost exclusively by left-wingers.
You and I both know that if you were to somehow poll the political orientation of everybody in the NPR news organization and at all of the member stations, you would find a progressive, liberal crowd, not uniformly, but overwhelmingly.
Journalism in general, reporters tend to be Democrats and tend to be more liberal than the public as a whole. Sure, but that doesn't change what is going out over the air.
Red Pilled America is an iHeartRadio original podcast. It's produced by me, Adriana Cortez, and Patrick Carelci for Inform Ventures. Now, our entire archive of episodes is only available to our Backstage subscribers. To subscribe, visit redpilledamerica.com and click support in the top menu. Thanks for listening.